Sherry Turkle writes, "Face-to-face conversation is the most human and humanizing thing we do." Yet Turkle says in contemporary society, we're seeing a flight from conversation to our phones, where we get a constant feed of connection, information, and entertainment. Sherry Turkle is a professor at MIT who focuses on our relationship to technology. Her most recent book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. It follows on the themes of her previous books, The Second Self and Alone Together. Turkle says the decline of face-to-face conversation has led to an assault on empathy. I spoke to her on November 5th, 2016, and she made the case for conversation.
My case for conversation is essentially a case for the development of empathy. Empathy and from empathy, the capacity not just to understand each other emotionally, but also politically in terms of ideas. I mean, the case goes on and on. But taking the most simple thing, in order to really understand another person, you have to be able to read them and to give them full attention. And my case is that right now we're interrupting ourselves and we're not giving each other full attention and we're losing the ability to train our children, perhaps is most significantly, to read each other and to develop those empathic cues. And you see evidence for that in the research. A recent study showed that over the past 30 years, there's been a 40% decline in all the ways we know how to measure empathy among college students, with most of that decline taking place in the past 10 years.
How about the research on conversation? You say we're in a flight from conversation.
Yes.
Is there research that we are actually talking less face-to-face than we used to?
Yes. And there's much research that shows, I mean, mine, but many other supporting studies, that people say that they would prefer to stay behind a screen than talk to the person in the next cubicle at work, than talk to their friends and have a difficult conversation. People want to protect themselves behind a screen, and the question is why. One young man I interviewed, I thought, summed up the argument against conversation when I said to him, "What's wrong with conversation?" He said, "Well, conversation, I'll tell you what's wrong with conversation. It takes place in real time, and you can't control what you're going to say." And he's right. And yet that is the argument for conversation, that we show ourselves to be sort of who we are in real time, and you are out of control a little bit of the flow back and forth of there's a sort of spontaneity and things can happen that you hadn't anticipated.
So we know there's a decline in empathy. We know there's a decline in conversation.
Yes.
How do we know that those two are connected?
Common sense and a series of studies that make the link. So, for example, if you sit at a lunch table and you put a phone on the table between you and the person you're having lunch with, and you turn the phone off and you turn it sort of face down, two things happen to the conversation. Number one, topics turn to more trivial subjects. Because nobody wants to even, I mean, this phone is turned off, but it reminds us of all the elsewheres that our phones can take us to.
It's a visual cue.
It's a visual cue that reminds us of how we live our lives. And secondly, each participant feels less of a connection, less of a stake, less of an empathic connection to the other. And if you redo this study with the phone really in the peripheral vision of the two people, you get the same results. So even a silenced phone in some way silences us in our ability to form empathic connections with other people. I see conversation as being part of a virtuous circle that includes solitude. In other words, my argument in Reclaiming Conversation is that you need to have the capacity for solitude in order to have the capacity for conversation. And why is that? It's because if you can center yourself, if you can gather yourself, then you can turn to another person and really hear who they are rather than need to project what you need them to be saying to buttress your sense of a fragile self.
That's very interesting. So the phones not only are keeping us from talking to one another, but they're also keeping us from solitude, those moments where we reflect
yes.
and where we're ready to talk.
Yes.
I'm speaking with MIT Professor Sherry Turkle. Her most recent book is called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age.
We can change our phones, and I believe it's time that we begin to design our phones in ways where they don't constantly interrupt us. Because right now, what my research shows is that people are intolerant of a moment of solitude. I study people at stop signs. 2 seconds, they pull out a phone. There's a very famous study, which is a study that asks college students to sit quietly with the device and then ask them, will you sit for 15 minutes without a device or a book? For money, and they say yes. Then you ask them, well, do you think you'd want to give yourself an electroshock during that time? And they say no.
Why would I want
to give myself an electroshock? That sounds unpleasant. It sounds like Stanley Milgram or some study I read about in college. Very bad idea. And you say, fine, no pressure. But you put them in a room and you take away their phone and you don't give them a book and you just have them seated in a chair, but with a handy electroshock machine at the table next to them. And in 6 minutes, they are a significant number of self-administering electroshocks, because the boredom of just sitting with no incoming is something that people simply cannot tolerate. And so when you see a baby bouncer with a slot for an iPad or an iPhone, a potty trainer with a slot for an iPad or an iPhone, the whole way in which we are now kind of socializing children, living our own life with the expectation that our phones will be constantly in our hands and interrupting us, we're creating a culture of interruption that is taking away this capacity. And I believe that the research is showing, and the educational results, and our kind of sense of well-being is starting to tell us that there's time for a change, and we can begin to make our devices differently and shape a digital world that gives us more capacity for solitude and thus capacity for conversation.
I'm speaking with MIT Professor Sherry Turkle. Her most recent book is called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. We also know we shouldn't eat fast food, and there's a lot more fresh food and better food available, and yet we don't see people going for the things that are better for them. Is there any evidence that if we realize that these devices are keeping us away from solitude and keeping us away from conversation, which could nurture us and not only benefit us but benefit society, is there any evidence that we can go back to that point? Or is it possible that we are actually untrained ourselves from being able to be alone and being able to talk? Have we changed as a species because of these devices?
Well, I don't really think of us as going back. I see us going forward with our phones, to a more mindful way of being with them, because I really am not arguing a kind of, detox, getting rid of the phones, turning them away, but really living more mindfully with them. And I'll give you a great example. I think it's a story I tell in Reclaiming of Marianne Wolfe, who's a reading scholar, who discovered on a vacation where she took her favorite author, Hermann Hesse, that she couldn't read The Glass Bead Game. She couldn't get through it. She could not read the book. And first, she thought that she might have gotten older, that she panicked. And then she calmed herself down and she realized that it was because the kind of reading she was doing, hyperlinks and online and online reading, she had lost the kind of capacity to sit quietly and read a novel. And over the course of a few weeks, she retrained herself to read a novel. Now, this is a woman for whom this was a great value. And this is happening. You, as a professor, I can see this with my students. They want to read shorter and shorter because they can only read shorter and shorter.
You alluded to the noted decline in empathy in our world, and we certainly see that tribalism has grown a lot, that people just are so out of touch with one another. We're in our own media bubbles where everything we read and hear about reinforces our own beliefs, and we see that in this political season. To what degree do you think reclaiming conversation might be, get walk us out of that.
I think it's crucial that it does. I mean, I think that the, where we are now and where we've allowed ourselves to get is dangerous. There's a study that college students will not talk to someone of a different political persuasion, even if they share a bathroom with them. We will not be able to govern ourselves if we continue on this way. So, I mean, a part of our ability to pull ourselves together and move forward has to be to reclaim empathy, reclaim conversation, be able to listen to each other. People can't listen. Part of talking is listening, and you can just see people having what they think of as conversations in which there is no listening. So the ability to listen to other people is actually quite hard. And I think it's something that's being lost. And I talk to my students about this because they're very articulate about how they find it difficult to listen to each other. They find it difficult to be in a class that's conversational.
I'm speaking with MIT professor Sherry Turkle. Her most recent book is called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. Let's be hopeful and say we do start talking again.
Yeah.
Are we going to be able to talk again? There's a lot of talk about us being in a post-factual world, a world where many people, and in fact, cognitive science tells us that if you have a deeply held belief, facts don't convince you away from that belief, and facts in fact, that it would disprove your belief, reinforce that belief. You feel even more strongly when presented with facts. So if this is true, if we're in a post-factual world where we can't even agree on what the truth is, how can we talk?
Well, I've read deeply on this post-factual hypothesis, and I think it's very interesting and very important. Certainly, this needs to be addressed head on. But actually, I think we can't afford to be in a post-factual world. I mean, I'm as much of a sociological theorist as anyone else, and this post-factual hypothesis is very brilliant and but we can't afford.
Well, we can't afford, but 60% of Republicans believe that President Obama is a Muslim.
Yes.
And this has been disproved all over and over and over again.
Right.
So we might not be able to afford to have people who don't believe in the facts,
right.
But in fact, they don't believe in the facts.
But then the question is, what kind of conversation is going to, I mean, I have to be an optimist because I don't think you can continue down this road and have a democracy. So I don't think you can have a post-factual world and a democratic one.
Most people will hear this after the election, and regardless of how it goes, there's going to be still be a deep divide.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on how to start the conversations we need to have after this election? How can you get to base one?
I think you have to start with something that people agree on, working on some community project where you can make common cause and then gradually just be talking and talking and talking to that person. You know, find yourself in a community with people who you wouldn't normally see.
Find something you have in common that you agree on, and maybe the conversation is how you can make that thing happen.
Yeah, like for example, I mean, I think that actually there's a lot of hopefulness in the issues that I'm interested in. Like, you know, do you want your school's curriculum to be all on iPads? You know, I'm taking the iPad. I mean, on digital is an interesting thing for parents to be discussing. This notion of children's attention and children kind of having their whole curriculum on a tablet. You know, parents of many persuasions can talk about that. Schools are kind of going in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And even if they disagree about the presidential election, they could talk about that.
Yes. I'm really serious. You know, because children's welfare and what is our children's welfare and children's attention and children's inability to talk. You know, parents may not want to talk to each other, but they don't like it that their children aren't able to talk.
We're talking about reclaiming conversation. That's the title of MIT professor Sherry Turkle's most recent book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. And we're talking about people talking to each other. There are a lot of major corporations that want us to talk to their machines. And in fact, artificial intelligence is making machines much more human-like, mm-hmm. so that you can almost have a conversation with a machine now. How does that factor into your thesis about the lack of human conversation really setting us back when it comes to empathy, when we start spending time talking, but we're talking to Alexa, we're not talking to a person?
Well, I think it's the fact that we've given up so much on face-to-face conversation with each other that sort of prepares the terrain for us to be willing to even contemplate talking to machines where all you can have is the pretense of empathy, fake empathy, as if empathy. You can't have empathy because there's no there's no person there to identify with your personhood and experience as a person, which is what empathy is. So there's only false relationship in a conversation with a machine. That doesn't mean that a chat with a robot can't give you all kinds of good information about where the nearest pizza place is and a reliable recommendation for, you know, for food and drink and museum opening times and all kinds of other great stuff and make your airline reservations for you. I love all of that. But this is not a Luddite. I'm not anti-technology. I'm pro-conversation. But you can't have pretend empathy and have that be part of a developmental process where you learn to connect with other people and connect with yourself. A machine does not have that to give. So I think it's more that we just need to – a machine can have the pretense, can fool you into thinking – that it's giving that, but that's not the same as being given it. And so the question for me, and my research question is always, why in this very important area of life, being understood in our deep humanity, do we want to be fooled? Why are we even considering that being fooled might be a good thing?
I want to ask you about that student you talked to at the beginning of our conversation who explained all the rational reasons why he didn't want to have a conversation
because
it was real time, it was messy, unexpected things could happen.
The quote was, what's wrong with conversation? It takes place in real time and you can't control what you're going to say. Well, I don't think it's a question of convincing anybody. I think that to make somebody more comfortable with conversation, you have to be more comfortable with solitude. You have to be more comfortable with what these students are trying to avoid is not seeming perfect. I mean, my students don't want to come to office hours very often. They want to send me a perfect email and get a perfect email back because it makes them feel in control. They've been raised to feel that they should be perfect and seem perfect, and they don't want to be vulnerable. So we have to step back and say, well, what values have we been putting out there for our kids? And if it's to be perfect and never vulnerable and never show who you really are, that doesn't make sense.
Well, one problem is that a lot of Trump voters don't want to talk to Clinton voters and vice versa. They have no desire whatsoever. They think they know everything they need to know about the other.
Yeah, but I think that's what has – I mean, I think this is the thing where as a country, as a polity, I think if we're going to make progress – I mean, that's where ultimately I think that my book, which began as a psychological study, became more and more political, and my interests have become more and more political, because as a polity, really our existence moving forward may depend on our ability to say we can't just shut this down. We want this to move forward. We need to talk to each other.